Chapter 5. Visit to Miss Wainfleet. Mr. Wake murmured a few more names to himself. Let me see now. Poor Mrs. Rose, and old Bell, and that child of the Elkins, and Harry Carter. They're not all my people, you understand. Mrs. Rose and Carter were dissenters, and that cold spell in March took off poor old Ben Stanbury at last. 92 he was.
Amy Gibbs died in April, said Bridget.
Yes, poor girl, a sad mistake to happen.
Luke looked up to find Bridget watching him. She lowered her eyes quickly. He thought with some annoyance, there's something here that I haven't got on to. Something to do with this Amy Gibbs. When they had taken their leave of the vicar and were outside again, he said, just who and what was Amy Gibbs? Bridget took a minute or two to answer. Then she said, and Luke noticed the slight constraint in her voice, Amy was one of the most inefficient housemaids I have ever known.
Well, that's why she got the sack?
No, she stayed out after hours playing about with some young man. Gordon has very moral and old-fashioned views. Sin, in his view, does not take place until after 11 o'clock, but then it is rampant. So he gave the girl notice, and she was impertinent about it.
Luke asked, a good-looking girl?
Very good-looking.
She's the one who swallowed hat paint in mistake for cough mixture.
Yes.
Rather a stupid thing to do, Luke hazarded.
Very stupid.
Was she stupid?
No, she was quite a sharp girl.
Luke stole a look at her. He was puzzled. Her replies were given in an even tone, without emphasis or even much interest, but behind what she said there was, he felt convinced, something not put into words. At that moment, Bridget stopped to speak to a tall man who swept off his hat and greeted her with breezy heartiness. Bridget, after a word or two, introduced Luke.
This is my cousin, Mr. Fitzwilliam, who is staying at the manor. He's down here to write a book. This is Mr. Abbott.
Luke looked at Mr. Abbott with some interest. This was the solicitor who had employed Tommy Pierce. Luke had a somewhat illogical prejudice against lawyers in general, based on the ground that so many politicians were recruited from their ranks. Also, their cautious habit of not committing themselves annoyed him. Mr. Abbott, however, was not at all the conventional type of lawyer. He was neither thin, spare, nor tight-lipped. He was a big, florid man, dressed in tweeds, with a hearty manner and a jovial effusiveness. There were little creases at the corners of his eyes, and the eyes themselves were more shrewd than one appreciated in a first casual glance.
Writing a book, eh? Novel?
Folklore, said Bridget.
You've come to the right place for that, said the lawyer. Wonderfully interesting part of the world here.
So I've been led to understand, said Luke. I dare say you could help me a bit. You must come across curious old deeds, or know of some interesting surviving customs.
Well, I don't know about that. Maybe, maybe.
Much belief in ghosts round here? Asked Luke.
As to that, I couldn't say. I really couldn't say.
No haunted houses?
No, I don't know of anything of that kind.
There's the child superstition, of course, said Luke.
Death of a boy child, a violent death, that is. The boy always walks, not a girl child.
Interesting, that.
Very,
said Mr. Abbott.
I never heard of that before.
Since Luke had just invented it, that was hardly surprising. Seems there was a boy here, Tommy something, was in your office at one time. I've reason to believe they think that he's walking. Mr. Abbott's red face turned slightly purple.
Tommy Pierce? Good-for-nothing, prying, meddlesome jackanapes.
Spirits always seem to be mischievous. Good law-abiding citizens seldom trouble this world after they've left it.
Who's seen him? What's this story?
These things are difficult to pin down, said Luke. People won't come out into the open with a statement, just in the air, so to speak.
Yes, yes, I suppose so.
Luke changed the subject adroitly. The real person to get hold of is the local doctor. They hear a lot in the poorer cases they attend, all sorts of superstitions and charms, probably love philters, and all the rest of it.
Oh, you must get on to Thomas.
Good fellow, Thomas. Thoroughly up-to-date man. Not like poor old Humbleby.
Bit of a reactionary, wasn't he?
Absolutely pig-headed. A die-hard of the worst description.
You had a real row over the water scheme, didn't you? Asked Bridget. Again a rich, ruddy glow suffused Abbott's face.
Humbleby stood dead in the way of progress, he said sharply. He held out against the scheme. He was pretty rude, too, in what he said. Didn't mince his words. Some of the things he said to me were positively actionable.
Bridget murmured. But lawyers never go to law, do they? They know better. Abbott laughed immoderately. His anger subsided as quickly as it had arisen.
Pretty good, Miss Bridget. And you're not far wrong. We who are in it know too much about law. Well, I must be getting along. Give me a call if you think I can help you in any way, Mr.
Fitzwilliam, said Luke.
Thanks, I will.
As they walked on, Bridget said, Your methods, I note, are to make statements and see what they provoke.
My methods, said Luke, are not strictly truthful, if that is what you mean.
I've noticed that. A little uneasy, he hesitated what to say next, but before he could speak, she said, If you want to hear more about Amy Gibbs, I can take you to someone who could help you.
Who is that?
A Miss Wainfleet. Amy went there after she left the manor. She was there when she died.
Oh, I see. He was a little taken aback. Well, thank you very much.
She lives just here.
They were crossing the village green. Inclining her head in the direction of the big Georgian house that Luke had noticed the day before, Bridget said,
That's Witch Hall. It's a library now.
Adjoining the hall was a little house that looked rather like a doll's house in proportion. Its steps were dazzlingly white, its knocker shone, and its window curtains showed white and prim. Bridget pushed open the gate and advanced to the steps. As she did so, the front door opened, and an elderly woman came out. She was, Luke thought, completely the country spinster. Her thin form was neatly dressed in a tweed coat and skirt, and she wore a grey silk blouse with a Cairngorm brooch. Her hat, a conscientious felt, sat squarely upon her well-shaped head. Her face was pleasant, and her eyes, through her pince-nez, decidedly intelligent. She reminded Luke of those nimble black goats that one sees in Greece. Her eyes held just that quality of mild, inquiring surprise.
"Good morning, Miss Wainfleet," said Bridget. "This is Mr. Fitzwilliam."
Luke bowed.
"He's writing a book about deaths and village customs and general gruesomeness."
"Oh, dear," said Miss Wainfleet. "How very interesting."
And she beamed encouragingly upon him. He was reminded of Miss Pinkerton.
"I thought," said Bridget, and again he noted that curious, flat tone in her voice, "that you might tell him something about Amy."
"Oh," said Miss Wainfleet, "about Amy?"
"Yes, about Amy Gibbs."
He was conscious of a new factor in her expression. She seemed to be thoughtfully summing him up. Then, as though coming to a decision, she drew back into the hall.
"Do come in," she said. "I can go out later."
"No, no,"
in answer to a protest from Luke. "I had really nothing urgent to do, just a little unimportant domestic shopping." The small drawing room was exquisitely neat and smelled faintly of burnt lavender. There were some Dresden china shepherds and shepherdesses on the mantelpiece, simpering sweetly. There were framed watercolours, two samplers, and three needlework pictures on the wall. There were some photographs of what were obviously nephews and nieces, and some good furniture, a Chippendale desk, some little satinwood tables, and a hideous and rather uncomfortable Victorian sofa. Miss Wainfleet offered her guests chairs, and then said apologetically,
"I'm afraid I don't smoke myself, so I have no cigarettes, but do please smoke if you like."
Luke refused, but Bridget promptly lighted a cigarette. Sitting bolt upright in a chair with carved arms, Miss Wainfleet studied her guest for a moment or two, and then, dropping her eyes as though satisfied, she said,
"You want to know about that poor girl Amy?
The whole thing was very sad and caused me a great deal of distress. Such a tragic mistake."
"Wasn't there some question of suicide?" asked Luke. Miss Wainfleet shook her head.
"No, no. That I cannot believe for a moment. Amy was not at all that type."
"What type was she?" asked Luke bluntly. I'd like to hear your account of her. Miss Wainfleet said,
Well, of course she wasn't at all a good servant, but nowadays really one is thankful to get anybody. She was very slipshod over her work and always wanting to go out. Well, of course she was young, and girls are like that nowadays. They don't seem to realize that their time is their employer's.
Luke looked properly sympathetic, and Miss Wainfleet proceeded to develop her theme.
She wasn't the sort of girl I care for, rather a bold type, though, of course, I wouldn't like to say much now that she's dead. One feels unchristian. Though, really, I don't think that that is a logical reason for suppressing the truth.
Luke nodded. He realized that Miss Wainfleet differed from Miss Pinkerton in having a more logical mind and better processes of thought.
She was fond of admiration, went on Miss Wainfleet, and was inclined to think a lot of herself. Mr. Ellsworthy, he keeps the new antique shop, but he is actually a gentleman. He dabbles a little in watercolours, and he had done one or two sketches of the girl's head, and I think, you know, that rather gave her ideas. She was inclined to quarrel with the young man she was engaged to, Jim Harvey. He's a mechanic at the garage, and very fond of her.
Miss Wainfleet paused, and then went on,
I shall never forget that dreadful night. Amy had been out of sorts. A nasty cough, and one thing and another. Those silly, cheap silk stockings they wear, and shoes with paper soles, practically. Of course they catch chills. And she'd been to the doctor that afternoon.
Luke asked quickly, Dr. Humbleby or Dr. Thomas?
Dr. Thomas. And he gave her the bottle of cough mixture that she brought back with her. Something quite harmless, a stock mixture, I believe. She went to bed early, and it must have been about 1 in the morning when the noise began. An awful kind of choking scream. I got up and went to her door, but it was locked on the inside. I called to her, but couldn't get any answer. Cook was with me, and we were both terribly upset. And then we went to the front door, and luckily there was Reed, our constable, just passing on his beat, and we called to him. He went round the back of the house and managed to climb up on the outhouse roof, and as her window was open, he got in quite easily that way and unlocked the door. Poor girl. It was terrible. They couldn't do anything for her, and she died in hospital a few hours later.
And it was, what, hat paint?
Yes, oxalic acid poisoning is what they called it. The bottle was about the same size as the Cofflinctus one. The latter was on her washstand, and the hat paint was by her bed. She must have picked up the wrong bottle and put it by her in the dark, ready to take if she felt badly. That was the theory at the inquest.
Miss Wainfleet stopped. Her intelligent goat's eyes looked at him, and he was aware that some particular significance lay behind them. He had the feeling that she was leaving some part of the story untold, and a stronger feeling that, for some reason, she wanted him to be aware of the fact. There was a silence. A long and rather difficult silence. Luke felt like an actor who does not know his cue. He said, rather weakly,
And you don't think it was suicide?
Miss Wainfleet said promptly,
Certainly not. If the girl had decided to make away with herself, she would have bought something, probably. This was an old bottle of stuff that she must have had for years. And anyway, as I've told you, she wasn't that kind of girl.
So you think what? Said Luke bluntly.
Miss Wainfleet said,
I think it was very unfortunate.
She closed her lips and looked at him earnestly. Just when Luke was feeling that he must try desperately to say something anticipated, a diversion occurred. There was a scratching at the door and a plaintive mew. Miss Wainfleet sprang up and went to open the door, whereupon a magnificent orange Persian walked in. He paused, looked disapprovingly at the visitor, and sprang upon the arm of Miss Wainfleet's chair. Miss Wainfleet addressed him in a cooing voice.
Why, Wonky Poo, where's my Wonky Poo been all the morning?
The name struck a chord of memory. Where had he heard something about a Persian cat called Wonky Poo? He said,
That's a very handsome cat. Have you had him long?
Miss Wainfleet shook her head.
Oh, no.
He belonged to an old friend of mine, Miss Pinkerton. She was run over by one of those horrid motor cars, and of course I couldn't have let Wonky Poo go to strangers. Lavinia would have been most upset. She simply worshipped him, and he is very beautiful, isn't he?
Luke admired the cat gravely.
Miss Wainfleet said, "Be careful of his ears. They've been rather painful lately."
Luke stroked the animal warily. Bridget rose to her feet. She said,
"We must be going."
Miss Wainfleet shook hands with Luke.
"Perhaps," she said, "I shall see you again before long."
Luke said cheerfully, "Oh, I hope so, I'm sure." He thought she looked puzzled and a little disappointed. Her gaze shifted to Bridget, a rapid look with a hint of interrogation in it. Luke felt that there was some understanding between the two women from which he was excluded. It annoyed him, but he promised himself to get to the bottom of it before long. Miss Wainfleet came out with them. Luke stood a minute on the top of the steps, looking with approval on the untouched primness of the village green and the duck pond. "Marvelously unspoiled, this place," he said. Miss Wainfleet's face lit up.
"Yes, indeed," she said eagerly. "Really, it is still just as I remembered it as a child. We lived in the hall, you know. But when it came to my brother, he did not care to live in it. Indeed, could not afford to do so. And it was put up for sale. A builder had made an offer and was, I believe, going to develop the land. I think that was the phrase. Fortunately, Lord Whitfield stepped in and acquired the property and saved it. He turned the house into a library and museum. Really, it is practically untouched. I act as librarian twice a week there, unpaid, of course. And I can't tell you what a pleasure it is to be in the old place and know that it will not be vandalized. And really, it is a perfect setting. You must visit our little museum one day, Mr. Fitzwilliam. There are some quite interesting local exhibits."
"I shall certainly make a point of doing so, Miss Wainfleet."
"Lord Whitfield has been a great benefactor to Witchwood," said Miss Wainfleet. "It grieves me that there are people who are sadly ungrateful."
Her lips pressed themselves together. Luke discreetly asked no more questions. He said goodbye again.
When they were outside the gate, Bridget said, "Do you want to pursue further researches, or shall we go home by way of the river? It's a pleasant walk."
Luke answered promptly. He had no mind for further investigations with Bridget Conway standing by listening. He said, "Go round by the river, by all means." They walked along the high street. One of the last houses had a sign decorated in old gold lettering with the word antiques on it. Luke paused and peered through one of the windows into the cool depths.
"Rather a nice slipware dish there," he remarked.
"Do for an aunt of mine. Wonder how much they want for it. Shall we go in and see?"
"Do you mind? I like pottering about antique shops. Sometimes one picks up a good bargain."
"I doubt if you will hear," said Bridget dryly. "Ellsworthy knows the value of his stuff pretty accurately, I should say."
The door was open. In the hall were chairs and settees and dressers with china and pewter on them. Two rooms full of goods opened at either side. Luke went into the room on the left and picked up the slipware dish. At the same moment, a dim figure came forward from the back of the room where he had been sitting at a Queen Anne walnut desk.
"Ah, dear Miss Conway, what a pleasure to see you."
"Good morning, Mr. Ellsworthy."
Mr. Ellsworthy was a very exquisite young man dressed in a colour scheme of russet brown. He had a long, pale face with a womanish mouth, long, black, artistic hair, and a mincing walk. Luke was introduced, and Mr. Ellsworthy immediately transferred his attention to him.
"Genuine old English slipware. Delicious, isn't it? I love my bits and pieces, you know. Hate to sell them. It's always been my dream to live in the country and have a little shop. Marvellous place, Witchwood. It has atmosphere, if you know what I mean."
"The artistic temperament," murmured Bridget.
Ellsworthy turned on her with a flash of long white hands.
"Not that terrible phrase, Miss Conway. No, no, I implore you. Don't tell me I'm all arty and crafty. I couldn't bear it, really, really, you know. I don't stock hand-woven tweeds and beaten pewter. I'm a tradesman, that's all, just a tradesman."
"But you're really an artist, aren't you?" said Luke. "I mean, you do watercolours, don't you?"
"Now who told you that?"
cried Mr. Ellsworthy, clasping his hands together.
"You know, this place is really too marvellous. One simply can't keep a secret. That's what I like about it. It's so different from that inhuman, you mind your business and I'll mind mine of a city. Gossip and malice and scandal, all so delicious if one takes them in the right spirit.
Luke contented himself with answering Mr. Ellsworthy's question and paying no attention to the latter part of his remarks.
Miss Wainfleet told us that you had made several sketches of a girl. Amy Gibbs.
Oh, Amy, said Mr. Ellsworthy.
He took a step backwards and set a beer mug rocking. He steadied it carefully. He said,
Did I? Oh, yes, I suppose I did.
His poise seemed somewhat shaken.
She was a pretty girl, said Bridget.
Mr. Ellsworthy had recovered his aplomb.
Oh, do you think so?
He asked.
Very commonplace, I always thought. If you're interested in slipwear, he went on to Luke, I've got a couple of slipwear birds, delicious things.
Luke displayed a faint interest in the birds and then asked the price of the dish. Ellsworthy named a figure.
Thanks, said Luke, but I don't think I'll deprive you of it after all. I'm always relieved, you know, said Ellsworthy, when I don't make a sale. Foolish of me, isn't it? Look here, I'll let you have it for a guinea less. You care for the stuff, I can see that. It makes all the difference, and after all, this is a shop.
No thanks, said Luke. Mr. Ellsworthy accompanied them out to the door, waving his hands. Very unpleasant hands, Luke thought they were. The flesh seemed not so much white as faintly greenish.
Nasty bit of goods, Mr. Ellsworthy, he remarked, when he and Bridget were out of earshot.
A nasty mind, and nasty habits, I should say, said Bridget.
Why does he really come to a place like this?
I believe he dabbles in black magic. Not quite black masses, but that sort of thing.
The reputation of this place helps. Luke said rather awkwardly, Good Lord. I suppose he's the kind of chap I really need. I ought to have talked to him on the subject.
Do you think so? Said Bridget. He knows a lot about it.
Luke said rather uneasily, I'll look him up some other day. Bridget did not answer. They were out of the town now. She turned aside to follow a footpath, and presently they came to the river. There they passed a small man with a stiff moustache and protuberant eyes. He had three bulldogs with him, to whom he was shouting hoarsely in turn.
Nero! Come here, sir! Nearly leave it! Drop it, I tell you! Augustus! Augustus, I say!
He broke off to raise his hat to Bridget, stared at Luke with what was evidently a devouring curiosity, and passed on, resuming his hoarse expostulations.
Major Horton and his bulldogs? Quoted Luke.
Quite right. Haven't we seen practically everyone of note in Witchwood this morning?
Practically.
I feel rather obtrusive, said Luke. I suppose a stranger in an English village is bound to stick out a mile, he added ruefully,
remembering Jimmy Lorimer's remarks.
Major Horton never disguises his curiosity very well, said Bridget.
He did stare, rather.
He's the sort of man you could tell was a major anywhere, said Luke, rather viciously.
Bridget said abruptly,
Shall we sit on the bank a bit? We've got lots of time.
They sat on a fallen tree that made a convenient seat.
Bridget went on, Yes, Major Horton is very military, has an orderly room manner. You'd hardly believe he was the most henpecked man in existence a year ago.
What, that fellow?
Yes, he had the most disagreeable woman for a wife that I've ever known. She had the money, too, and never scrupled to underline the fact in public.
Poor brute. Horton, I mean.
He behaved very nicely to her, always the officer and gentleman. Personally, I wonder he didn't take a hatchet to her.
She wasn't popular, I gather.
Everybody disliked her. She snubbed Gordon and patronized me and made herself generally unpleasant wherever she went.
But I gather a merciful providence removed her.
Yes, about a year ago. Acute gastritis. She gave her husband, Dr. Thomas, and two nurses absolute hell. But she died all right.
The bulldogs brightened up at once.
Intelligent brutes.
There was a silence. Bridget was idly picking at the long grass. Luke frowned at the opposite bank unseeingly. Once again, the dreamlike quality of his mission obsessed him. How much was fact? How much imagination? Wasn't it bad for one to go about studying every fresh person you met as a potential murderer? Something degrading about that point of view.
Damn it all, thought Luke.
I've been a policeman too long. He was brought out of his abstraction with a shock. Bridget's cold, clear voice was speaking. Mr. Fitzwilliam, she said, just exactly why have you come down here? Chapter 6 Hat Paint. Luke had been just in the act of applying a match to a cigarette. The unexpectedness of her remark momentarily paralyzed his hand. He remained quite motionless for a second or two, then the match burned down and scorched his fingers. Damn, said Luke, as he dropped the match and shook his hand vigorously. Beg your pardon, you gave me rather a nasty jolt. He smiled ruefully.
Did I?
Yes. He sighed. Oh, well, I suppose any one of real intelligence was bound to see through me. That story of my writing a book on folklore didn't take you in for a moment, I suppose.
Not after I'd once seen you.
You believed it up to then?
Yes.
All the same, it wasn't really a good story, said Luke critically. I mean, any man might want to write a book, but the bit about coming down here and passing myself off as a cousin, I suppose that made you smell a rat.
Bridget shook her head.
No, I had an explanation for that. I thought I had, I mean. I presumed you were pretty hard up. A lot of my and Jimmy's friends are that, and I thought he suggested the cousin stunt so that, well, so that it would save your pride.
But when I arrived, said Luke, my appearance immediately suggested such opulence that that explanation was out of the question.
Her mouth curved in its slow smile.
Oh, no, she said. It wasn't that. It was simply that you were the wrong kind of person.
Not sufficient brains to write a book?
Don't spare my feelings, I'd rather know.
Oh, you might write a book, but not that kind of book.
Old superstitions? Delving into the past?
Not that sort of thing.
You're not the kind of man to whom the past means much.
Perhaps not even the future.
Only just the present.
I see. He made a wry face. Damn it all. You've made me nervous ever since I got here. You look so confoundedly intelligent.
I'm sorry, said Bridget dryly. What did you expect?
Well, I really hadn't thought about it.
But she went on calmly. A fluffy little person with just enough brains to realize her opportunities and marry her boss?
Luke made a confused noise. She turned a cool, amused glance on him.
I quite understand. It's all right. I'm not annoyed.
Luke chose effrontery.
Well, perhaps it was something faintly approaching that, but I didn't think much about it.
She said slowly,
No, you wouldn't. You don't cross your fences till you get to them.
But Luke was despondent.
Oh, I've no doubt I did my stuff pretty rottenly. Has Lord Whitfield seen through me too?
Oh, no.
If you said you'd come down here to study the habits of water beetles and write a monograph about them, would have been okay with Gordon. He's got a beautiful, believing mind.
All the same, I wasn't a bit convincing. I got rattled somehow.
I cramped your style, said Bridget.
I saw that. It rather amused me, I'm afraid.
Oh, it would. Women with any brains are usually cold-bloodedly cruel.
Bridget murmured,
One has to take one's pleasures as one can in this life.
She paused a minute, then said,
Why are you down here, Mr. Fitzwilliam?
They had returned full circle to the original question. Luke had been aware that it must be so. In the last few seconds, he had been trying to make up his mind. He looked up now and met her eyes, shrewd, inquiring eyes that met his with a calm, steady gaze. There was a gravity in them, which he had not quite expected to find there.
It would be better, I think, he said meditatively, not to tell you any more lies.
Much better.
But the truth's awkward. Look here, have you yourself formed any opinion? I mean, has anything occurred to you about my being here?
She nodded slowly and thoughtfully.
What was your idea? Will you tell me? I fancy it may help somehow.
Bridget said quietly,
I had an idea that you came down here in connection with the death of that girl, Amy Gibbs.
That's it, then. That's what I saw, what I felt. Whenever her name cropped up, I knew there was something.
So you thought I came down here about that?
Didn't you?
In a way, yes. He was silent, frowning. The girl beside him sat equally silent, not moving. She said nothing to disturb his train of thought. He made up his mind. I've come down here on a wild goose chase, on a fantastical and probably quite absurd and melodramatic supposition. Amy Gibbs is part of that whole business. I'm interested to find out exactly how she died.
Yes, I thought so.
But dash it all, why did you think so? What is there about her death that, well, aroused your interest? Bridget said, I've thought all along that there was something wrong about it. That's why I took you to see Miss Wainfleet. Why? Because she thinks so too. Oh. Luke thought back rapidly. He understood now the underlying suggestions of that intelligent spinster's manner. She thinks as you do, that there's something odd about it. Bridget nodded. Why exactly? Hat paint, to begin with. Well, what do you mean, hat paint? Well, about 20 years ago, people did paint hats. One season you had a pink straw, next season a bottle of hat paint and it became dark blue, then perhaps another bottle and a black hat. But nowadays, hats are cheap, tawdry stuff to be thrown away when out of fashion. Even girls of the class of Amy Gibbs. I'd be more likely to paint a hat than she would. Thrift's gone out. And there's another thing. It was red hat paint. Well, and Amy Gibbs had red hair, carrots. You mean it doesn't go together? Bridget nodded. You wouldn't wear a scarlet hat with carroty hair. It's the sort of thing a man wouldn't realize, but... Luke interrupted her with heavy significance. No, a man wouldn't realize that. It fits in. It all fits in. Bridget said, Jimmy has got some odd friends at Scotland Yard. You're not, Luke said quickly, I'm not an official detective, and I'm not a well-known private investigator with rooms in Baker Street, etc. I'm exactly what Jimmy told you I was, a retired policeman from the East. I'm horning in on this business because of an odd thing that happened in the train to London. He gave a brief synopsis of his conversation with Miss Pinkerton and the subsequent events which had brought about his presence in Witchwood. So you see, he ended, it's fantastic. I'm looking for a certain man, a secret killer. A man here in Witchwood, probably well known and respected. If Miss Pinkerton's right, and you're right, and Miss What's-Her-Name is right, that man killed Amy Gibbs. Bridget said, I see. It could have been done from outside, I suppose?
Yes, I think so, said Bridget slowly.
Reed, the constable, climbed up to her window by means of an outhouse. The window was open. It was a bit of a scramble, but a reasonably active man would find no real difficulty. And having done that, he did what? Substituted a bottle of hat paint for the Cofflingters, hoping she'd do exactly what she did do. Wake up, drink it off, and that everyone would say she'd made a mistake or committed suicide.
Yes.
There was no suspicion of what they call in books foul play at the inquest.
No.
Men again. I suppose that hat paint point wasn't raised.
No.
But it occurred to you.
Yes.
And to Miss Wainfleet. Have you discussed it together? Bridget smiled faintly.
Oh, no, not in the sense you mean.
I mean, we haven't said anything right out. I don't really know how far the old pussy has gone in her own mind. I'd say she'd been just worried to start with, and gradually getting more so. She's quite intelligent, you know. Went to Girton, or wanted to, and was advanced when she was young. She's not got quite the woolly mind of most of the people down here.
Miss Pinkerton had rather a woolly mind, I should imagine, said Luke. That's why I never dreamed there was anything in her story to begin with.
She was pretty shrewd, I always thought, said Bridget. Most of these rambling old dears are as sharp as nails in some ways.
You said she mentioned other names.
Luke nodded. Yes, a small boy. That was Tommy Pierce. I remembered the name as soon as I heard it, and I'm pretty sure that the man Carter came in too.
Carter? Tommy Pierce? Amy Gibbs, Dr. Humbleby, said Bridget thoughtfully. As you say, it's almost too fantastic to be true. who on earth would want to kill all those people? They were all so different.
Luke said, Any idea as to why anyone should want to do away with Amy Gibbs?
Bridget shook her head. Can't imagine.
What about the man Carter? How did he die, by the way?
Fell into the river and was drowned. He was on his way home. It was a misty night, and he was quite drunk. There's a footbridge with a rail on only one side. It was taken for granted that he missed his footing.
But someone could quite easily have given him a shove.
Oh, yes.
And somebody else could quite easily have given nasty little Tommy a push when he was window cleaning.
Again, yes.
So it boils down to the fact that it's really quite easy to remove three human beings without anyone suspecting.
Miss Pinkerton suspected,
Bridget pointed out.
So she did, bless her.
She wasn't troubled with ideas of being too melodramatic or of imagining things.
She often told me the world was a very wicked place.
And you smiled tolerantly, I suppose.
In a superior manner.
Anybody who can believe six impossible things before breakfast wins hands down at this game.
Bridget nodded.
Luke said, I suppose it's no good my asking you if you've a hunch of any kind. There's no particular individual in Witchwood who gives you a creepy feeling down the spine, or who has strange pale eyes or a queer maniacal giggle. Everybody I've met in Witchwood appears to me to be eminently sane, respectable, and completely ordinary.
I was afraid you'd say that, said Luke.
Bridget said, You think this man is definitely mad?
Oh, I should say so. A lunatic, all right.
But a cunning one. The last person you'd ever suggest. Probably a pillar of society, like a bank manager.
Mr. Jones?
I certainly can't imagine him committing wholesale murders.
Well, then he's probably the man we want.
It may be anyone, said Bridget. The butcher, the baker, the grocer, farm labourer, a road mender, or the man who delivers the milk.
It may be, yes.
But I think the field is a little more restricted than that.
Why?
My Miss Pinkerton spoke of the look in his eyes when he was measuring up his next victim. From the way she spoke, I got the impression, it's only an impression, mark you, that the man she was speaking of was at least her social equal. Of course, I may be wrong.
You're probably quite right. Those nuances of conversation can't be put down in black and white, but they're the sort of things one doesn't really make mistakes about.
You know, said Luke, it's a great relief to have you knowing all about it.
It'll probably cramp your style less, I agree. And I can probably help you.
Your help will be invaluable.
You really mean to see it through?
Of course.
Luke said with a sudden slight embarrassment,
What about Lord Whitfield? Do you think...
Naturally, we won't tell Gordon anything about it, said Bridget.
You mean he wouldn't believe it?
Oh, he'd believe it.
Gordon could believe anything. He'd probably be simply thrilled and insist on having half a dozen of his bright young men down to beat up the neighbourhood. He'd simply adore it.
That does rather rule it out, agreed Luke.
Yes, we can't allow him to have his simple pleasures, I'm afraid.
Luke looked at her.
He seemed about to say something, then changed his mind. He looked instead at his watch.
Yes, said Bridget, we ought to be getting home.
She got up. There was a sudden constraint between them, as though Luke's unspoken words hovered uncomfortably in the air. They walked home in silence.
Chapter 7 Possibilities. Luke sat in his bedroom. At lunchtime, he had sustained an interrogation by Mrs. Anstruther as to what flowers he had had in his garden in the Mayang Straits. He had then been told what flowers would have done well there. He had also listened to further talks to young men on the subject of myself by Lord Whitfield. Now he was mercifully alone. He took a sheet of paper and wrote down a series of names. It ran as follows. Dr. Thomas, Mr. Abbott, Major Horton, Mr. Ellsworthy, Mr. Wake, Mr. Jones, Amy's young man, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, etc. And then he took another sheet of paper and headed it Victims. Under this heading he wrote Amy Gibbs, poisoned. Tommy Pierce, pushed out of window. Harry Carter, shoved off footbridge. Drunk? Drugged? Dr. Humbleby, blood poisoning. Miss Pinkerton, run down by car. He added, Mrs. Rose? Old Ben? And after a pause, Mrs. Horton. He considered his lists, smoked a while, then took up his pencil once more. Dr. Thomas, possible case against him. Definite motive in the case of Dr. Humbleby. Manner of latter's death suitable, namely, scientific poisoning by germs. Amy Gibbs visited him on afternoon of the day she died. Anything between them? Blackmail? Tommy Pierce. No connection known. Did Tommy know of connection between him and Amy Gibbs? Harry Carter? No connection known. Was Dr. Thomas absent from Wychwood on the day Miss Pinkerton went to London? Luke sighed and started a fresh heading. Mr. Abbott, possible case against him. Feel a lawyer is definitely a suspicious person, possibly prejudice. His personality, florid, genial, etc., would be definitely suspicious in a book. Always suspect bluff, genial men. Objection. This is not a book, but real life. Motive for murder of Dr. Humbleby. Definite antagonism existed between them. H. defied Abbott. Sufficient motive for a deranged brain. Antagonism could have been easily noted by Miss Pinkerton. Tommy Pierce? Latter snooped among Abbott's papers. Did he find out something he shouldn't have known? Harry Carter? No definite connection. Amy Gibbs? No connection known. Hat paint, quite suitable to Abbott's mentality. An old-fashioned mind. Was Abbott away from the village the day Miss Pinkerton was killed? Major Horton. Possible case against him. No connection known with Amy Gibbs, Tommy Pierce, or Carter. What about Mrs. Horton? Death sounds as though it might be arsenical poisoning. If so, other murders might be a result of that. Blackmail? N.B. Thomas was doctor in attendance. Suspicious for Thomas again. Mr. Ellsworthy. Possible case against him. Nasty bit of goods, dabbles in black magic. Might be temperament of a bloodlust killer. Connection with Amy Gibbs. Any connection with Tommy Pierce, Carter? Nothing known. Humbleby? Might have tumbled to Ellsworthy's mental condition. Miss Pinkerton? Was Ellsworthy away from Wychwood when Miss Pinkerton was killed? Mr. Wake? Possible case against him. Very unlikely. Possible religious mania? A mission to kill? Saintly old clergyman likely starters in books, but as before, this is real life. Note, Carter, Tommy, Amy, all definitely unpleasant characters. Better removed by divine decree? Mr. Jones. Data, none. Amy's young man. Probably every reason to kill Amy, but seems unlikely on general grounds. The etceteras? Don't fancy them. He read through what he had written. Then he shook his head. He murmured softly, which is absurd. How nicely Euclid put things. He tore up the lists and burnt them. He said to himself, this job isn't going to be exactly easy. Chapter 7. Possibilities. Luke sat in his bedroom. At lunchtime, he had sustained an interrogation by Mrs. Anstruther as to what flowers he had had in his garden in the Mayang Straits. He had then been told what flowers would have done well there. He had also listened to further talks to young men on the subject of myself by Lord Whitfield. Now, he was mercifully alone. He took a sheet of paper and wrote down a series of names. It ran as follows. Dr. Thomas, Mr. Abbott, Major Horton, Mr. Ellsworthy, Mr. Wake, Mr. Jones, Amy's young man, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, etc. And then he took another sheet of paper and headed it Victims. Under this heading he wrote Amy Gibbs, poisoned. Tommy Pierce, pushed out of window. Harry Carter, shoved off footbridge. Drunk? Drugged? Dr. Humbleby, blood poisoning. Miss Pinkerton, run down by car. He added, Mrs. Rose? Old Ben? And after a pause, Mrs. Horton. He considered his list, smoked a while, then took up his pencil once more. Dr. Thomas. Possible case against him. Definite motive in the case of Dr. Humbleby. Manner of latter's death suitable, namely, scientific poisoning by germs. Amy Gibbs visited him on afternoon of the day she died. Anything between them? Blackmail? Tommy Pierce. No connection known. Did Tommy know of connection between him and Amy Gibbs? Harry Carter? No connection known. Was Dr. Thomas absent from Wychwood on the day Miss Pinkerton went to London? Luke sighed and started a fresh heading. Mr. Abbott. Possible case against him. Feel a lawyer is definitely a suspicious person, possibly prejudice. His personality, florid, genial, etc., would be definitely suspicious in a book. Always suspect bluff, genial men. Objection. This is not a book, but real life. Motive for murder of Dr. Humbleby. Definite antagonism existed between them. H. defied Abbott. Sufficient motive for a deranged brain. Antagonism could have been easily noted by Miss Pinkerton. Tommy Pierce? Latter snooped among Abbott's papers. Did he find out something he shouldn't have known? Harry Carter? No definite connection. Amy Gibbs? No connection known. Hat paint, quite suitable to Abbott's mentality. An old-fashioned mind. Was Abbott away from the village the day Miss Pinkerton was killed? Major Horton. Possible case against him. No connection known with Amy Gibbs, Tommy Pierce, or Carter. What about Mrs. Horton? Death sounds as though it might be arsenical poisoning. If so, other murders might be a result of that. Blackmail? N.B. Thomas was doctor in attendance. Suspicious for Thomas again. Mr. Ellsworthy. Possible case against him. Nasty bit of goods, dabbles in black magic. Might be temperament of a bloodlust killer. Connection with Amy Gibbs. Any connection with Tommy Pierce, Carter? Nothing known. Humbleby? Might have tumbled to Ellsworthy's mental condition. Miss Pinkerton? Was Ellsworthy away from Wychwood when Miss Pinkerton was killed? Mr. Wake? Possible case against him. Very unlikely. Possible religious mania? A mission to kill? Saintly old clergymen likely starters in books, but as before, this is real life. Note, Carter, Tommy, Amy, all definitely unpleasant characters. Better removed by divine decree? Mr. Jones. Data, none. Amy's young man. Probably every reason to kill Amy, but seems unlikely on general grounds. The et cetera's? Don't fancy them. He read through what he had written. Then he shook his head. He murmured softly, which is absurd. How nicely Euclid put things. He tore up the lists and burnt them. He said to himself, this job isn't going to be exactly easy. Chapter 8. Dr. Thomas. Dr. Thomas leant back in his chair and passed a long, delicate hand over his thick, fair hair. He was a young man whose appearance was deceptive. Though he was over 30, a casual glance would have put him down in the early 20s, if not in his teens. His shock of rather unruly, fair hair, his slightly startled expression, and his pink and white complexion gave him an irresistibly schoolboyish appearance. Immature as he might look, though, the diagnosis he had just pronounced on Luke's rheumatic knee agreed almost precisely with that delivered by an eminent Harley Street specialist only a week earlier. Thanks, said Luke. Well, I'm relieved you think that electrical treatment will do the trick. I don't want to turn a cripple at my age. Dr. Thomas smiled boyishly. I don't think there's any danger of that, Mr. Fitzwilliam. Well, you've relieved my mind, said Luke. I was thinking of going to some specialist chap, but I'm sure there's no need now. Dr. Thomas smiled again. Go if it makes your mind easier. After all, it's always a good thing to have an expert's opinion. No, I got full confidence in you. Frankly, there's no complexity about the matter. If you take my advice, I'm quite sure you'll have no further trouble. You've relieved my mind no end, Doctor. Fancied I might be getting arthritis, and would soon be all tied up in knots and unable to move. Dr. Thomas shook his head with a slightly indulgent smile. Luke said quickly, Men get the wind up pretty badly in these ways. I expect you find that. I often think a doctor must feel himself a medicine man, a kind of magician to most of his patients. The element of faith enters in very largely. I know. The doctor says so is a remark always uttered with something like reverence. Dr. Thomas raised his shoulders. If one's patients only knew, he murmured humorously. Then he said, You're writing a book on magic, aren't you, Mr. Fitzwilliam? Now, how did you know that? Exclaimed Luke, perhaps with somewhat overdone surprise. Dr. Thomas looked amused. Oh, my dear sir, news gets about very rapidly in a place like this. We have so little to talk about. It probably gets exaggerated, too. You'll be hearing I'm raising the local spirits and emulating the Witch of Endor. Rather odd you should say that. Why? Well, the rumour has been going around that you had raised the ghost of Tommy Pierce. Pierce? Pierce, is that the small boy who fell out of a window? Yes. Now, I wonder how. Oh, of course, I made some remark to the solicitor. What's his name? Abbott? Yes, the story originated with Abbott. Don't say I've converted a hard-boiled solicitor to a belief in ghosts. You believe in ghosts yourself, then? Your tone suggests that you do not, Doctor. No, I wouldn't say I actually believe in ghosts, to put it crudely. But I have known curious phenomena in the case of sudden or violent death. But I'm more interested in the various superstitions pertaining to violent deaths. That a murdered man, for instance, can't rest in his grave, and the interesting belief that the blood of a murdered man flows if his murderer touches him. I wonder how that arose. Very curious, said Thomas, but I don't suppose many people remember that nowadays. More than you would think. Of course, I don't suppose you have many murders down here, so it's hard to judge. Luke had smiled as he spoke, his eyes resting with seeming carelessness on the other's face. But Dr. Thomas seemed quite unperturbed and smiled in return. No, I don't think we've had a murder for, very many years. Certainly not in my time. No, this is a peaceful spot. Not conducive to foul play, unless somebody pushed little Tommy, what's his name, out of the window. Luke laughed. Again, Dr. Thomas's smile came in answer, a natural smile full of boyish amusement. A lot of people would have been willing to wring that child's neck, he said, but I don't think they actually got to the point of throwing him out of windows. He seems to have been a thoroughly nasty child. The removal of him might have been conceived as a public duty. It's a pity one can't apply that theory fairly often. I've always thought a few wholesale murders would be beneficial to the community, said Luke. A club bore, for instance, should be finished off with a poisoned liqueur brandy. Then there are the women who gush at you and tear all their dearest friends to pieces with their tongues, backbiting spinsters, inveterate diehards who oppose progress. If they were painlessly removed, what a difference it would make to social life. Dr. Thomas's smile lengthened to a grin. In fact, you advocate crime on a grand scale. Judicious elimination, said Luke. Don't you agree that it would be beneficial? Oh, undoubtedly. Ah, but you're not being serious, said Luke. Now I am. I haven't the respect for human life that the normal Englishman has. Any man who is a stumbling block on the way to progress ought to be eliminated. That's how I see it. Running his hand through his short, fair hair, Dr. Thomas said, Yes, but who is to be the judge of a man's fitness or unfitness? Well, that's the difficulty, of course, Luke admitted. The Catholics would consider a communist agitator unfit to live. The communist agitator would sentence the priest to death as a purveyor of superstition. The doctor would eliminate the unhealthy man. The pacifist would condemn the soldier and so on. You'd have to have a scientific man as judge, said Luke. Someone with an unbiased but highly specialized mind, a doctor, for instance. Come to that. I think you'd be a pretty good judge yourself, doctor. Of unfitness to live? Yes. Dr. Thomas shook his head. My job is to make the unfit fit. Most of the time it's an uphill job, I'll admit. Now, just for the sake of argument, said Luke, take a man like the late Harry Carter. Dr. Thomas said sharply, Carter? You mean the landlord of the Seven Stars? Yes, that's the man. I never knew him myself, but my cousin, Miss Conway, was talking about him. He seems to have been a really thoroughgoing scoundrel. Well, said the other, he drank, of course. Ill-treated his wife, bullied his daughter. He was quarrelsome and abusive, and had had a row with most people in the place. In fact, the world is a better place without him. One might be inclined to say so, I agree. In fact, if somebody had given him a push and sent him into the river, instead of his kindly electing to fall in of his own accord, that person would have been acting in the public interest. Dr. Thomas said dryly, These methods that you advocate, did you put them into practice in the Mayang Straits, I think you said? Luke laughed. Oh, no. With me, it's theory, not practice. No, I do not think you are the stuff of which murderers are made. Luke asked, Why not? I've been frank enough in my views. Exactly. Too frank. You mean that if I were really the kind of man who takes the law into his own hands, I shouldn't go about airing my views. That was my meaning. But it might be a kind of gospel with me. I might be a fanatic on the subject. Even so, your sense of self-protection would be active. In fact, when looking for a murderer, look out for a nice, gentle, wouldn't-hurt-a-fly type of man. Slightly exaggerated, perhaps, said Dr. Thomas, but not far from the truth. Luke said abruptly, Tell me, it interests me, have you ever come across a man whom you believed might be a murderer? Dr. Thomas said sharply, Really, what an extraordinary question. Is it? After all, a doctor must come across so many queer characters. He would be better able to detect, for instance, the signs of homicidal mania in an early stage, before it's noticeable. Thomas said rather irritably, You have the general layman's idea of a homicidal maniac. A man who runs amok with a knife, a man more or less foaming at the mouth. Let me tell you, a homicidal lunatic may be the most difficult thing on this earth to spot. To all seeming, he may be exactly like everyone else. A man, perhaps, who is easily frightened, who may tell you, perhaps, that he has enemies. No more than that, a quiet, inoffensive fellow. Is that really so? Of course it's so. A homicidal lunatic often kills, as he thinks, in self-defense. But of course, a lot of killers are ordinary, sane fellows like you and me. Doctor, you alarm me. Fancy, if you should discover later that I have 5 or 6 nice, quiet little killings to my credit. Dr. Thomas smiled. I don't think it's very likely, Mr. Fitzwilliam. Don't you? I'll return the compliment. I don't believe you've got 5 or 6 murders to your credit either. Dr. Thomas said cheerfully, You're not counting my professional failures. Both men laughed. Luke got up and said goodbye. I'm afraid I've taken up a lot of your time, he said apologetically. Oh, I'm not busy. Witchwood is a pretty healthy place. It's a pleasure to have a talk with someone from the outside world. I was wondering, said Luke, and stopped. Yes? Miss Conway told me, when she sent me to you, what a first-class man you were. I wondered if you didn't feel rather buried down here. Not much opportunity for talent. Oh, general practice is a good beginning. It's valuable experience. But you won't be content to stay in a rut all your life. Your late partner, Dr. Humbleby, was an unambitious fellow, so I've heard, quite content with his practice here. He'd been here for a good many years, I believe. Practically a lifetime. He was sound, but old-fashioned, so I hear. Dr. Thomas said, At times he was difficult, very suspicious of modern innovations, but a good example of the old school of physicians. Left a very pretty daughter, I'm told, said Luke in jocular fashion. He had the pleasure of seeing Dr. Thomas's pale pink countenance go a deep scarlet. Oh, yes, he said. Luke gazed at him kindly. He was pleased at the prospect of erasing Dr. Thomas from his list of suspected persons. The latter recovered his normal hue and said abruptly, Talking about crime just now, I can lend you rather a good book, as you're interested in the subject. Translation from the German, Kreutzhammer on inferiority in crime.
Oh, thank you, said Luke.
Dr. Thomas ran his finger along a shelf and drew out the book in question. Here you are. Some of the theories are rather startling. And of course, they're only theories, but they are interesting. The early life of Menzhelt, for instance, the Frankfurt Butcher, as they called him, and the chapter on Anna Helm, the little nursemaid killer, are really extremely interesting.
She killed about a dozen of her charges before the authorities tumbled to it, I believe, said Luke.
Dr. Thomas nodded. Yes, she had a most sympathetic personality, devoted to children, and apparently quite genuinely heartbroken at each death. The psychology is amazing.
Amazing how these people get away with it, said Luke. He was on the doorstep now.
Dr. Thomas had come out with him.
Not amazing, really, said Dr. Thomas. It's quite easy, you know.
What is?
To get away with it.
He was smiling again, a charming, boyish smile.
If you're careful. One just has to be careful, that's all. But a clever man is extremely careful not to make a slip. That's all there is to it.
He smiled and went into the house. Luke stood staring up the steps. There had been something condescending in the doctor's smile. Throughout their conversation, Luke had been conscious of himself as a man of full maturity, and of Dr. Thomas as a youthful and ingenuous young man. Just for a moment, he felt the roles reversed. The doctor's smile had been that of a grown-up, amused by the cleverness of a child. Chapter 9. Mrs. Pierce Talks. In the little shop in the High Street, Luke had bought a tin of cigarettes and today's copy of Good Cheer, the enterprising little weekly, which provided Lord Whitfield with a good portion of his substantial income. Turning to the football competition, Luke, with a groan, gave forth the information that he had just failed to win £120. Mrs. Pierce was roused at once to sympathy and explained similar disappointments on the part of her husband. Friendly relations thus established, Luke found no difficulty in prolonging the conversation.
"A great interest in football, Mr. Pierce takes," said Mr. Pierce's spouse. "Turns to it first of all in the news, he does, and as I say, many a disappointment he's had. But there, everybody can't win, that's what I say. And what I say is you can't go against luck."
Luke concurred heartily in these sentiments and proceeded to advance by an easy transition to a further profound statement that troubles never came singly.
"Ah, no, indeed, sir, that I do know."
Mrs. Pierce sighed, and when a woman has a husband and 8 children, 6 living and buried 2, that is, well, she knows what trouble is, as you may say.
"I suppose she does. Oh, undoubtedly," said Luke.
"You've buried 2, you say?"
"One no longer than a month ago," said Mrs. Pierce, with a kind of melancholy enjoyment.
"Dear me, very sad."
"It wasn't only sad, sir, it was a shock. That's what it was, a shock. I came over all queer, I did, when they broke it to me, never having expected anything of that kind to happen to Tommy, as you might say, for when a boy's a trouble to you, it doesn't come natural to think of him being took. Now, my Emma Jane, a sweet little mite she was, you'll never rear her, that's what they said, she's too good to live. And it was true, sir. The Lord knows his own."
Luke acknowledged the sentiment and strove to return from the subject of the saintly Emma Jane to that of the less saintly Tommy.
"Your boy died quite recently," he said. "An accident?"
"An accident it was, sir. Cleaning the windows of the old hall, which is now the library. He must have lost his balance and fell from the top windows, that was."
Mrs. Pierce expatiated at some length on all the details of the accident.
"Wasn't there some story," said Luke carelessly, "of his having been seen dancing on the windowsill?"
Mrs. Pierce said that boys would be boys, but no doubt it did give the Major a turn, him being a fussy gentleman.
"Major Horton?"
"Yes, sir, the gentleman with the bulldogs. After the accident happened, he chanced to mention having seen our Tommy acting very rash-like, and of course it does show that if something sudden had startled him, he would have fallen easily enough."
"Aye, spirit, sir, that was Tommy's trouble. A sore trial he's been to me in many ways," she finished. "But there it was. Just high spirits, nothing but high spirits, such as any lad might have. There wasn't no real harm in him, as you might say."
"No, no, I'm sure there wasn't.
But sometimes, you know, Mrs. Pierce, people, sober, middle-aged people, find it hard to remember they've ever been young themselves."
Mrs. Pierce sighed. Very true, those words are, sir. I can't help but hoping that some gentleman I could name, but won't, will have taken it to heart the way they were hard upon the lad, just on account of his high spirits.
Played a few tricks upon his employers, did he? Asked Luke, with an indulgent smile.
Mrs. Pierce responded immediately.
It was just his fun, sir, that was all. Tommy was always good at imitations.
Make us hold our sides with laughing the way he'd mince about pretending to be that Mr. Ellsworthy at the curio shop, or old Mr. Hobbs, the church warden, and he was imitating his lordship up at the manor, and the two undergardeners laughing, when up come his lordship quiet-like and gave Tommy the sack on the spot, and naturally, that was only to be expected and quite right, and his lordship didn't bear malice afterwards and helped Tommy to get another job.
But other people weren't so magnanimous, eh? Said Luke.
That they were not, sir, naming no names, and you'd never think it with Mr. Abbott, so pleasant in his manner, and always a kind word or a joke.
Tommy got into trouble with him,
Mrs. Pierce said. It's not, I'm sure, that the boy meant any harm. And after all, if papers are private and not meant to be looked at, they shouldn't be laid out on a table, that's what I say.
Oh, quite, said Luke. Private papers in a lawyer's office ought to be kept in the safe.
That's right, sir. That's what I think, and Mr. Pierce, he agrees with me. It's not even as though Tommy had read much of it.
What was it? A will? Asked Luke.
He judged, probably rightly, that a question as to what the document in question had been might make Mrs. Pierce halt. But this direct question brought an instant response.
Oh, no, sir, nothing of that kind. Nothing really important, just a private letter it was, from a lady.
And Tommy didn't even see who the lady was. All such a fuss about nothing, that's what I say.
Mr. Abbott must be the sort of man who takes offence very easily, said Luke.
Well, it does seem so, doesn't it, sir? Although, as I say, he's always such a pleasant gentleman to speak to, always a joke or a cheery word. But it's true that I have heard he was a difficult man to get up against, and him and Dr. Umbleby was daggers drawn, as the saying is, just before the poor old gentleman died, and not a pleasant thought for Mr. Abbott afterwards. For once there's a death, one doesn't like to think there's been harsh words spoken and no chance of taking them back.
Luke shook his head solemnly and murmured, Very true, very true. He went on, A bit of a coincidence, that. Hard words with Dr. Humbleby, and Dr. Humbleby died. Harsh treatment of your Tommy, and the boy dies. I should think that a double experience like that would tend to make Mr. Abbott careful of his tongue in future.
Harry Carter, too, down at the Seven Stars, said Mrs. Pierce. Very sharp words passed between them, only a week before Carter went and drowned himself.
But one can't blame Mr. Abbott for that. The abuse was all on Carter's side. Went up to Mr. Abbott's house, he did, being in liquor at the time, and shouting out the foulish language at the top of his voice. Poor old Mrs. Carter, she had a deal to put up with, and it must be owned Carter's death was a merciful release as far as she was concerned.
He left a daughter too, didn't he?
Ah, said Mrs. Pierce.
I'm never one to gossip.
This was unexpected, but promising. Luke pricked up his ears and waited.
I don't say there was anything in it but talk. Lucy Carter's a fine-looking young woman in her way, and if it hadn't been for the difference in station, I dare say no notice would have been taken. But talk there has been, and you can't deny it, especially after Carter went right up to his house, shouting and swearing.
Luke gathered the implications of this somewhat confused speech.
Mr. Abbott looks as though he'd appreciate a good-looking girl, he said.
It's often the way with gentlemen, said Mrs. Pierce. They don't mean anything by it, just a word or two in passing, but the gentry's the gentry, and it gets noticed in consequence. It's only to be expected in a quiet place like this.
It's a very charming place, said Luke. So unspoiled.
That's what artists always say, but I think we're a bit behind the times myself.
Why, there's been no building here to speak of. Over at Ashfell, for instance, they've got a lovely new lot of houses, some of them with green roofs and stained glass in the windows.
Luke shuddered slightly.
You've got a grand new institute here, he said.
They say it's a very fine building, said Mrs. Pierce, without great enthusiasm. Of course, his lordship's done a lot for the place.
He means well, we all know that.
But you don't think his efforts are quite successful, said Luke, amused.
Well, of course, sir. He isn't really gentry. Not like Miss Wainfleet, for instance, and Miss Conway.
Why, Lord Whitfield's father kept a boot shop only a few doors from here. My mother remembers Gordon Ragg serving in the shop, remembers it as well as anything.
Of course, he's his lordship now, and he's a rich man.
but it's never the same, is it, sir?
Evidently not, said Luke.
You'll excuse me mentioning it, sir, said Mrs. Pierce. And of course, I know you're staying at the manor and writing a book, but you're a cousin of Miss Bridget's, I know, and that's quite a different thing. Very pleased we shall be to have her back as mistress of Ash Manor.
Rather, said Luke. I'm sure you will.
He paid for his cigarettes and paper with sudden abruptness. He thought to himself, the personal element, one must keep that out of it. Hell, I'm here to track down a criminal. What does it matter who that black-haired witch marries or doesn't marry? She doesn't come into this. He walked slowly along the street. With an effort, he thrust Bridget into the back of his mind. Now then, he said to himself, Abbott. The case against Abbott. I've linked him up with three of the victims. He had a row with Humbleby, a row with Carter, and a row with Tommy Pierce, and all three died. What about the girl Amy Gibbs? What was the private letter that infernal boy saw? Did he know who it was from, or didn't he? He mayn't have said so to his mother, but suppose he did. Suppose Abbott thought it necessary to shut his mouth. It could be. That's all one can say about it. It could be. Not good enough. Luke quickened his pace, looking about him with sudden exasperation. This damned village, it's getting on my nerves. So smiling and peaceful, so innocent, and all the time this crazy streak of murder running through it. Or am I the crazy one? Was Lavinia Pinkerton crazy? After all, the whole thing could be coincidence. Yes, Humbleby's death and all. He glanced back down the length of the high street, and he was assailed by a strong feeling of unreality. He said to himself, these things don't happen. Then he lifted his eyes to the long, frowning line of Ash Ridge, and at once the unreality passed. Ash Ridge was real. It knew strange things, witchcraft, and cruelty, and forgotten bloodlusts, and evil rites. He started. Two figures were walking along the side of the ridge. He recognized them easily, Bridget and Ellsworthy. The young man was gesticulating with those curious, unpleasant hands of his. His head was bent to Bridget's. They looked like two figures out of a dream. One felt that their feet made no sound as they sprang cat-like from turf to turf. He saw her black hair stream out behind her, blown by the wind. Again, that queer magic of hers held him. Bewitched. That's what I am, bewitched, he said to himself. He stood quite still, a queer, numbed feeling spreading over him. He thought to himself ruefully, who's to break the spell? There's no one.